Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Sound okay?
We hear you on Zoom. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. Oh, yeah, one more thing. So, the title of my talk today is Creating Wisdom from Ignorance, and it's talking about the sixth grave precept. I'd like to begin by acknowledging a couple of things. Tomorrow is Groundhog's Day, or as it's called in another liturgical calendar, Candlemas, and in yet another older tradition, Imbolc. It's a cross-quarter day midway between winter solstice and the spring equinox. As such, it is both the depth of winter and a time to turn towards spring. When I was living on the East Coast, that turning was palpable to me as just the slightest whisper of a tremor underground, under a thick blanket of snow and seemingly dead grass, shrubs, and trees. Here on the West Coast, it's more subtle, but we still know that we may have an early spring this year, or we may still get snow and ice before spring is firmly established. There was a movie called Groundhog's Day, which I saw many years ago. It tells the story of a man who keeps waking up on the same day, the same loud, obnoxious wake-up alarm, the radio loudly proclaiming, "It's Groundhog's Day." He goes about his day as a TV weather forecaster, predicting that the snowstorm will miss them and that it would be clear and cold. However, the day ends as snow begins to fall heavily. He lives this day over and over, trying to court a woman who keeps rejecting him over and over. He even takes piano lessons to impress her. Doesn't work. For a while, he despairs, even killing himself in various ways, only to wake up again the next morning to the same day. Loud alarm, radio announcement of Groundhog's Day, no snow on the ground, and still no idea of what's going on. It's a humorous movie and somewhat absurd, but there is a serious message underneath it all. No matter what happens, how many mistakes he makes, he gradually learns to soften into the experience and let go of the certainty of being in control. He lets go of playing a part and trying to pretend to be the perfect person, and something finally works. He finally wakes up on February 3rd, no alarm, a lot of snow on the ground, and the woman beside him. I tell people who despair of ever making progress that we have all the time we need to allow practice to work on us. The practice works differently with different people depending on individual karma, and there is no timeline. Traditional Buddhist teaching says that if you don't get it in this life, there's always the next one. But you don't even have to believe that. You only have right now, always. And it's all you need. Last week, Kakamyo said that everything is moving toward enlightenment. It's not necessarily on my timeline, it's not automatic, and it does require effort and humility. This morning, we celebrated Nehan, the parinirvana of the Buddha. It may sound strange to celebrate the death of our founder, Shakyamuni, but there are several important teachings there. The one I want to focus on right now is the inexorable turning of the earth and the wheel of life. We are born, we live, we suffer, age, and die. Sickness, aging, and death come to all of us. Outside, the grasses and the shrubs and the trees appear to die, and many of them die in truth, but have shed seeds onto the ground, all waiting for the rebirth of spring. It is an important time of year, teaching us that it is important to die, to rest, to make room for rebirth, new life. The cycle happens over and over. We see this perhaps more in some seasons than others. For me, this time of year is notable both for the beauty of stark simplicity and for the potential of what's happening where we can't see it. It's a time of year where we can celebrate not knowing, turning toward a new season of growth. With all of that up to where we are, we turn to the sixth grave precept, and it reads this way. Do not dwell on past mistakes. Create wisdom from ignorance. In the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expounding upon error is the precept of not dwelling on past mistakes. In the Buddha Dharma, there is one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. Do not engage in fault finding. Do not condone haphazard talk. So the first time I learned about the precepts was in an introductory workshop on starting a practice, which we still do these workshops regularly, usually about once a month. We read through them and I thought complacently, I got all that. Maybe even, oh, it seems easy enough. And as I look back on it, I can think both, boy, was I wrong, and something in me recognized the truth of these and immediately found accord with them. So see what I just did there? I illustrated both the dwelling on a past mistake and the development of wisdom from previous ignorance. Simple, right? Maybe I could stop right there and let you all go home. And of course I won't. One suggestion from the workshop leader in those long ago days was to recite the precepts every morning and see what jumps out at you. This particular one was the precept that came up first for me. I sensed already that one of my karmic obstacles was self-judgment, that I spent too much of my time berating myself for various mistakes. In fact, one morning, as I was driving to work, I know exactly where I was, and I can see my hands on the steering wheel. I no longer recall which car I was driving, and I no longer recall the transgression that I was regretting. I was kind of obsessing, talking to myself about it, saying things like, you idiot, how could you do that? What is wrong with you? I can't believe you did that, and so on and so forth. You all know the drill. Suddenly, the words of this precept came to me, and the mind just stopped, suddenly realizing, hey, this is dwelling on a past mistakes. Okay, now, does what I'm doing make any sense? Does it actually improve things? Is it fixing anything? As I considered it, I realized that all it was doing was to make me feel worse. So this is part of how we work with the precepts. We notice. We notice what's going on. We notice what comes up. As I reflect on this now and dig down further, I realize that I somehow thought, believed, based on childhood experiences, that the point of punishment for a misdeed was to make one feel terrible. That feeling terrible was a requirement in payment for making a mistake. Pain, guilt, suffering, these were all considered the inevitable outcome for making a mistake. Any other feeling was seemingly not allowed. That actually made it more difficult to find a constructive solution or a way forward because I thought feeling terrible was the point of recognizing a mistake. I remember thinking, well, I'll never do that again. And that was as far as I could go. And I no longer remember what that was. At some point, I began to understand two things. First, that punishment generally had little or nothing to do with whatever mistake I had supposedly made, but was the result of some prior pain that the one doing the punishing was passing along for their own attempt at relief. And second, that feeling terrible about it was extra, not required, and often created more obstacles and suffering. In fact, it is actually expounding upon error, which the precept specifically calls out. Remembering those two things has been immensely helpful. First, it's not about me. Second, feeling terrible is extra and just adds to the suffering. So the word dwell has to do with attachment. Clinging to a particular view of something, concretizing a narrative around it, lots of blame attached. But mistakes in themselves are simply mistakes, and they happen to everyone. Another aspect of this dwelling on past mistakes is to consider the mistakes of others. When I encountered the precept, I thought only of my own mistakes, and that's an accurate reflection of how I viewed the world then, that it was all about me. The mistakes of others generally didn't bother me so much, but it's all so easy and unhelpful to get attached and resentful about others' transgressions, to carry a grudge, if you will. When that comes out in speech, it's called haphazard talk or gossip. Mind you, it is important sometimes to call out abusive or unskillful behavior, especially if it's ongoing. But dwelling on it doesn't help. Finding a wise response needs to be done carefully in as neutral a way as possible. As Gyokaku points out in the precept study guide about this precept, we may have to be ready to reveal some ugly truths, but we don't have to say them in an ugly way. We don't have to get attached to our own position or think of ourselves as separate from those making the mistakes. Recognizing that there are difficulties on both sides of a conflict, that things aren't always simple, that there isn't always an easy way out. These are important to keep in mind. The entry in the study guide continues with a student commenting, "When we get hung up on our past mistakes, there's a wonderful opportunity to take ignorance and blame into this moment and create something new." Many mistakes are small, benign, and easily remedied. As timekeeper for the Beginner's Day retreat a couple of weeks ago, I mistakenly thought that we had an hour of Zazen at midday, and so I rang a bell at a half an hour and announced posture adjustment. I later learned that some people in the retreat were thinking, "Oh no, more sitting." But in a moment, the shuso came over to me and pointed out on the schedule where it said it was supposed to be a silent break. I said, "Huh, so it is." I rang the bell twice and announced silent break. Simple. No need to feel embarrassed or terrible. Over and done. I will say that it has taken a lot of years of practice to feel this okay about making mistakes. Granted that many of our mistakes are more serious and or more complicated than this, the basic structure is the same. Acknowledge, repair, and along with that, hopefully comes learning, understanding, and then to resolve to do better. In this case, I realized after the fact that I was caught up in the habit energy of our Ongo midday sit and wasn't paying attention to what was actually required in that moment, an all too common scenario. I resolved to pay closer attention in the future. So again, the first step in creating wisdom from ignorance is to drop the obstacles of ego, personalizing the situation to make it all about me, and to let go of internalized depression that says you have to feel terrible about it. Often the next step is to understand the problem, or at least some aspects of the problem. And this is the opposite of making excuses, defending the self. Real understanding can come from using the RAIN acronym. Many of you are familiar with this, but I'll just run over it really quickly again. R-A-I-N. R is recognize what has happened. A is accept that it has happened. I is to investigate how it happened. So step by step, noticing the body, the feelings, the thoughts, paying attention to the actual situation. Non-identification with it, getting the self and the ego out of the way. The contrition verse at the beginning of our journey into the precepts lays out another way to look at this process. That verse goes like this: "All my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hatred, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow." In the precept study guide, Kyogen says, contrition is rather like confession, which is simply to acknowledge that there is something to do, something to work on. We acknowledge that we screw up in various ways, that we aren't perfect, and that there is a long karmic stream that flows through us. I've always loved that word beginningless, which says that there's no blame attached. a recognition that it didn't start with me. We have a responsibility to deal with it wisely, but as the seventh precept about praise and blame points out, blaming is often just a way to try to solve the problem by figuring out who is at fault, which then expounds upon error and solves nothing. Remember that blame is extra. So how does all of this relate to creating wisdom? How do we do it? How does it work? Well, of course, we've already begun to work on it. Clearing out obstacles, interrupting old karmic patterns is one way of discovering wisdom. And much of our practice is exactly that. Early on in the Kyoju Kaimon, the three treasures are described this way. The highest truth is called the Buddha treasure. Immaculacy is called the Dharma treasure. Harmony is called the Sangha treasure. I understand the highest truth, and I understand harmony. What is immaculacy? Some years back, I looked it up and found that it literally means free from flaws or mistakes, perfect, perfectly clean, neat, or tidy. It comes from Latin macula, or spot. So immaculate means unstained or spotless. So what does it mean to say that the Dharma treasure is immaculacy? For that, I'm going to Dogen, reading from the Shobo Genzo fascicle, Buddha Nature. The Buddha said, if you want to understand Buddha nature, you should intimately observe cause and effect over time. When the time is ripe, Buddha nature manifests. The words to understand Buddha nature do not only mean to know, but also to practice it, to realize it, to expound it, and to let go of it. Expounding it, practicing it, realizing it, letting go of it, missing it, and not missing it at all, are cause and effect over time. You observe cause and effect over time through observation of cause and effect over time. You observe it with a whisk, a staff, and so forth. However, you may observe it through the wisdom of desire, the wisdom of beyond desire, original enlightenment, embryonic enlightenment, no enlightenment, or true enlightenment. Intimately observe is not limited to observing, being observed, correct observation, or wrong observation. It is intimately observed. As it is intimate observing, it is not self-observation or others' observation. Intimate observing is cause and effect as they are over time, and it is beyond cause and effect. It is Buddha nature as it is. It is becoming free of the body of Buddha nature. It is Buddha and Buddha as they are. Buddha nature and nature as they are. Hearing the words, when the time is ripe, many people, both in the past and present, have thought that it means we should wait until Buddha nature manifests in the future. That as a result of practice, we will eventually encounter the time when Buddha nature manifests, and that when the time is not ripe, Buddha nature will not manifest, even if we inquire about the Dharma from a teacher and endeavor in the practice of the way. They think this way and stay in the secular world of red dust, fruitlessly, while keeping a monk's appearance. Such people appear to be those outside of the way who believe in spontaneous enlightenment. The words, if you want to understand Buddha nature, mean, if you want to understand Buddha nature immediately. Observe cause and effect over time means you should know cause and effect over time. You should intimately observe cause and effect over time means that if you want to know Buddha nature, it is no other than knowing cause and effect over time. When the time is ripe means that the time has already arrived. How can we doubt it? A time of doubting also is a time when Buddha nature is present to to the self. Know that when the time is ripe means that the 12 hours of the day are not passed in vain. When the time is like saying when the time has arrived. When the time has arrived is not the arrival of Buddha nature. Thus, when the time has arrived, Buddha nature is already actualized. This principle is self-evident. Generally, there is no time when the time has not yet arrived. There is no Buddha nature that is not actualized. What I see from this text is that pure mind, clean, unstained mind, immaculate mind, the Buddha mind itself, is already present in each of us. This means that we manifest it by practicing over and over again. Dogen repeats this theme throughout his teaching. We don't practice for the sake of someday becoming enlightened. We practice as a result of our already enlightened Buddha nature. And so in the very beginning, when I first heard the precepts and reacted with, "I got all that," I wasn't completely wrong. I was manifesting Buddha nature in that moment. What I still had to discover is that enlightenment or wisdom is not something you achieve and then have forever. It's not a thing you can put in your pocket or get a gold star for. It means we have to keep showing up, keep practicing with the precepts, keep opening to learning new things, keep dropping the self and allowing the world to continue to teach us. Because it does that, to the extent that we allow ourselves to see it, new opportunities for growing, learning, and wisdom come at us all the time. It is inevitable that we will miss some opportunities, mess up in various ways, and perhaps end up with regrets. This is part of the human condition and part of the process. The precepts give us a description of a life lived with wisdom, in accord with our Buddha nature. By studying this, we can begin to see more clearly our own karmic patterns and obstacles, begin to soften around them, and allow them gradually to drop away. To do this requires compassion, especially compassion for ourselves. The contrition verse reminds us that karma did not begin with me. The Kyoju Kaimon invokes compassion from the beginning. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas give us this teaching because of their limitless compassion. This causes them to fling wide the gates of compassion to all living things. Although karmic consequence is inevitable at some point in the three periods of time, that is the past, the present, and the future, contrition brings freedom and immaculacy. As this is so, let us be utterly contrite before the Buddha. This means that when we turn towards the precepts from the very beginning, we already have freedom and immaculacy. We are already on the path. So now I want to talk about forgiveness. A couple of weeks ago, a fella in prison was asking about what to do with intrusive thoughts during meditation. When I asked what kind of intrusive thoughts, he answered with regrets about the past. So what is the relationship between the past and the present moment when they are linked by regret? We all have things in our past that we wish we had done differently. And we all wish things that others had done some things differently. And there's not always an opportunity, nor do we always know how to repair the damage, whether at the time or later. And so, then what? This is where forgiveness comes in. Acceptance, tolerance, forbearance, patience. A Sanskrit word is kshanti, and it's one of the six paramitas or perfections that we cultivate. There's a bumper sticker that reads, "Forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past." Forgiveness doesn't say that it doesn't matter or that it was okay what happened. Forgiveness simply accepts that what happened did in fact happen. I have feelings about it. I may regret it. I may be angry. I may wish I or others had done something different. Compassion means that I see and acknowledge that what happened hurt someone. Could be someone else. Often is me. Regardless, my first task is to heal in whatever way I can, to find my way to acceptance and, if possible, to understanding. It may be that there was no other way to act in a situation. It may be, and often is, that the situation was set up long before with other, perhaps unwise or maybe just uninformed actions. It is almost always true that the reasons given for a given action are vast and complex, as Kakamyo pointed out in his talk last week. So vast and complex that it is impossible to know and understand them all completely. To top it all off, unskilled action may also result from not having the resources to make a good decision. Not enough sleep, stress from other conditions in your life, like grief and loss, inadequate nutrition, physical or mental impairment, lack of knowledge. Still, unskillful action happened and it had a harmful effect. This is what we call karma. The word means action, cause, and effect. The tie between cause and effect isn't always simple, usually isn't, as a matter of fact. And as I pointed out, you can't even chase down the source of a particular karmic stream. It goes back and back and back before that. The contrition verse says it is beginningless. Even though I didn't start it, it is important to recognize, to admit, to avow that it is now mine. To repair the damage insofar as I can, and to vow to do better in the future. This is wisdom. I want to end by talking a little bit about the Walk for Peace. Many of you may be following it. Several monks, I don't think I ever counted them, are walking from Texas to Washington, D.C. with a single sign that says Walk for Peace and a stray dog that they picked up and not much more. Okay, volunteer support staff and various things. But that's not their message. They just keep walking. I admire them and they seem to be having an effect on many people. A website following them says that the monks are currently in Virginia today in harsh winter conditions with snow, sleet, and frozen roads. This is their 99th day of walking in a 120-day, 2,300-mile trek, advocating for unity, compassion, and healing across the nation. They are expected to reach the capital on February 13th. The monks released this statement about why they are walking. Rooted in both spiritual devotion and civic purpose, the Walk for Peace seeks to remind Americans that peace is not a destination, it is a practice. As the nation faces challenges of division, mental health crises, and conflict, both here at home and abroad, this pilgrimage offers a simple yet profound message. Peace begins within the heart of each person and extends outward to families, communities, and the nation as a whole. The website notes that anyone is welcome to walk alongside them for a few miles, attend reflection gatherings, or follow updates on social media as the monks journey towards DC. Here's an excerpt from a Facebook post. Unfortunately, I didn't get the name of the original poster that spoke about the effects of this walk on this one person. Peace isn't rare because people don't want it. It's rare because it requires presence, not opinion. Most of us think peace is a belief, a stance, or something we agree with when it shows up on our screen. But peace doesn't actually ask what we think. It asks where we are. These monks are walking whether anyone is watching or not, whether they're praised or ignored, whether someone misunderstands their intentions or projects their assumptions onto them, the walk doesn't stop to defend itself. It doesn't explain itself. It just keeps moving. This walk doesn't negotiate with comfort. It doesn't wait for consensus. It just shows up again the next day. Peace isn't passive at all. It's disciplined. It's repetitive. It's quiet work done in public spaces without demanding attention. Peace isn't loud. It doesn't trend. It doesn't rush. It just keeps walking. And so the world keeps turning. Life keeps going forward. We keep practicing, showing up, doing the best we can. We acknowledge our human mistakes and forgive them, along with the human mistakes of others. Open to comments and questions.
If you are in the room and you have a question, please raise your hand. I'll bring you the microphone. Please hold it close to your mouth and state your name before you ask your question. If you are on Zoom and have a question, you can either type your name into the chat and the co-host will unmute you so you can ask your question, or you can type your question into the chat and the co-host will read it for you.
This is Jesus O. Thank you, Ginkgo. Your RAIN acronym reminded me of, rather forcefully, of a long phone call I had with my brother yesterday. When this happens, I'm doing 10% of the talking, he's doing 90%. And anyway, he began by telling me about all of his kind of medical problems, in particular kind of his stomach and digestion and all that that's messed up. And then he started telling me about some screw up in his business in which a bank had committed an error and was causing him a lot of grief. And he was going on and on about this. And when he's done, I said, you're pretty stressed that you thought about the fact that your stress about this might be contributing to the way you're feeling. And his response was to repeat the story.
Right.
And I mean, there was no point in me kind of pointing that out.
Right.
But it was just kind of, it made me think actually about, you know, that him not getting to the end, the non-attachment to this situation. Mm-hmm. And I realized I do the same thing.
Uh-huh.
we seem to have learned from a master.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, it's that old karma. It just keeps coming along.
Yeah. Great.
This is Mess. I don't mean this literally, but I'm wondering, Genko, what is your walk for peace right now?
It's sitting in this chair, in this seat, is part of it. It's going into the prisons. It's cleaning up after lunch. It's many things. It's every single step, every single day. And whether I'm actively thinking about peace as a thing or not, that's what it's all about.
So. Thank you.
This is Ed. I want to comment and thank you for really, you know, I feel like in this talk, it was such a journey going from Groundhog Day, the movie, to Groundhog Day, cultural phenomenon, to practical acronyms like RAIN. Mm-hmm. And the profundity of the text that you read, and the current events, the person and your personal connection to them. And I want to acknowledge that really breadth. So thank you.
Yeah, it was an interesting talk to do because I began this term when we first started reciting the Kyoji Paimon, that precept just jumped out at me in a different way than it ever had before. Now, mind you, I've been doing this practice for 25 years. And, we pay attention to the precepts every year. And something about reading at this time is just, there was something that really grabbed a hold of me. And so I've been writing bits and pieces at various times, which is not usually how I write. And then I tried to put it all together, and it's been very interesting. Last night I was thinking, I think there's something that needs to be organized differently. But when I read over it, it was like, oh, well, okay, it sort of flows. It's going to work. And there's a lot to it. It's longer than a talk that I would typically do, but I think it kind of captures where I'm at with it at the moment. I'm glad that was useful to you.
Thank you.
This is Gyoshi. You brought up regrets, and actually from the very beginning of your talk, regrets kept on echoing through my mind. And I just wanted to express how valuable I find regrets to be. And for myself, I find value in finding the theme of regrets. And for me, most of my regrets are around ways that I've hurt people in the past. No regrets about what I chose for a lifestyle or, that mm-hmm. kind of thing, but mm-hmm. just about ways that I've harmed people.
Right.
And they, following up on that, I find that they all come from a paradigm of separation.
Right.
And I find that really valuable, because now when I make that same mistake, it immediately reflects to me where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. And my behavior around that has changed substantially just because of recognizing the harm that I've done. So I can't say that I've dropped the regrets, and I actually have no interest in dropping the regrets. Mm-hmm. But I think this is that create wisdom from ignorance.
Yes, it definitely is. And I don't think I say in here that we shouldn't have regrets.
No.
Because in fact, I think it's true that almost all of our regrets have to do with harming others. At least that's been true for me as well. Maybe other people have different kinds of regrets. I don't know. I guess I can't say I know everything about everybody. But although I think I should, I suppose, part of me. I think when we can see our regrets, these feelings about things that have happened in the past, it's useful to take a look at them. The question has to do with how attached we get to them. That's the thing about dwelling.
Yeah.
When we get attached to them and concretize them and identify with them and say, oh, I'm a terrible person because. All of that is where we went into problems.
Guy, thank you for your talk. The RAIN acronym is something that I also appreciated and kind of thought about maybe could be used in the context of, a collective, like, truth and reconciliation process. Have you ever thought of that?
Could very well be. It's a teaching that's been around for quite a while and is used in a variety of ways, I'm sure. But I haven't specifically considered that.
I'm just thinking about it because, our practice is really focused on dealing with our own mm-hmm. internal or, personal karma and so on. But, we're in a time now where I'm sure a lot of people are concerned about the karma on the collective level,
I think we're always in those kinds of times.
Yeah, well, you're probably right.
And I think we each find our own way in how we work with that. For myself, I find that I needed to work on my own karma first. That gives me an opportunity then to share compassion with other people. And I do that in a variety of ways. And I do think that that's where this has to start. And I also agree that it can and needs to go out to others in a variety of different ways. And each of us has to find our own way to that, because we're all different people, have different kinds of karmic streams that we're dealing with.
Hi, I'm Benny.
Hi, Benny.
I was wondering if you could elaborate more on other people's mistake. I think for me, like there's a necessity of correcting somebody when they're acting unskillfully. And there's another moment where somebody, you want to let the people, like the person, make that mistake for them to realize and create their own wisdom.
Right.
So I'm curious about when to discern, when to make that correction, and when to just let them do it.
It's something. As a teacher, I find that I enjoy teaching people and training people. And also I have to really pay a lot of attention to, you know, when does it make sense to say, okay, now just a note, this is supposed to be like this. And because you can overwhelm people with that kind of stuff. And you can also make it sound kind of punitive or, you know, you just have to be careful about how you say it. And you also have to say, I can't fix everybody. You know, this is not, none of this is about fixing. If a person, if you can tell the person is open to hearing something, then, and you have something that you think would be useful and helpful for them, then you can say it. But there's not nearly as many of those kinds of times as I would love to say, right? I mean, I love giving advice. I can see what everybody else should do really well. And it's not useful for most people. It's very much like what Jitsuso was just talking about with his brother. You know, you can say, well, you know, you might want to consider. And it's like, goes right over the head. Like, okay, we'll just double back down on where we're at. And that happens more often than we would like. And that's just how it is. So that's where we get into the patience part of it. You know, just sort of like, that's just the way it is right now. And there's not really anything I can constructively do about that. And yeah, discerning that is hard. It takes time and practice, and we still don't always get it right.
Thank you.
Wish I could give you a better answer than that, but that's how it is.
I'm Sally. Thank you for your talk. I'm also someone who has a big tendency toward negative self-talk, internal criticism. And when I listened to Geshe's comment, it reminded me of something a Dharma sister of mine used to say. She said, there was a point in my practice where I realized I was leaving a lot of wreckage in my wake. And I decided I would like to just try to do a little less of that. And for me, that was extraordinarily helpful because it got me out of my own head and thinking a little bit more about my impact in the world. But also it felt like that's a standard I might actually be able to live with, work with, like just to leave a little less.
Taking that next step.
Yeah, exactly.
And not trying to get all the way there immediately. It's like wherever there is. It's like, okay, this is what's in front of me. This is the next thing I can do. And, you know, Yokoko used to use the term baby steps, which I always kind of liked. Take baby steps, and we just keep doing that, and it's fine. It works very well.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, how are we doing? Maybe that's enough. All right, thank you all for your kind attention.